ShoeCast. 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 None of these are any good.
I would use all of these.
ShoeCast. ShoeCast. Welcome back to the Stitch Down ShoeCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things that we love about it. I'm Ben from StitchDown.com, and unfortunately, Ticho is busy preparing 16 dozen DiGiorno croissant crust pizzas, which are honestly very excellent, for the local chapter of the Lions Club and wherever the hell he lives in New Jersey. So unfortunately, he's not going to be here today for a really very exciting guest here on the ShoeCast, Phil Callis, which I believe I pronounced correctly, and he didn't tell me right before the show that that was right. Co-founder of Ashland Leather, which makes fantastic wallets and belts and watch bands and all manner of other leather goods, and who dared to have me babble on Ashland's YouTube channel just so he could get on here, or this is some sort of payback for how terribly I did. We'll see. We don't know what Phil has up his sleeve here or what his aims are. Before we get rolling, we just wanted to give a special shout-out to our sponsor this week, Grant Stone, benevolent Stitch Down Patina Thunderdome presenting sponsor and quite possibly the best value in Goodyear welted footwear, period. Give them a look at GrantStoneShoes.com. Also, if you love the ShoeCast, you'll love the Stitch Down Premium Discord even more because it's full of people talking relentlessly about boots and shoes all day long and more at night, really. Except everyone is much smarter and more charming and hilarious and generally more pleasant than Ticho and I. Plus, members get discounts on Grant Stone, Parkhurst, and Sagara, access to all sorts of early and limited release stuff, giveaways of all kinds, and the warm knowledge that your membership supports this very ShoeCast right here. It's the world's greatest place, I think. Promise you'll love it. Get on in there. Plenty more info at StitchDown.com. But here we go. Let's bring him in. He put in a decade and a half at Horween Leather. He's now the co-founder of Ashland Leather, the man who, frankly, is kind of a better looking version of me. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Phil Callis.
What's up, Ben? You got me smiling that whole intro here. That was awesome. And that croissant pizza. 11 croissant pizzas? What is that?
No, I think it was like 16 dozen. There's a lot 16. Of Lions in that club.
Man.
And it's good. So everybody wants like half a pizza. Actually, I got one of these the other night and sent Ticho a picture. And I was like, the future is now, man. Here we go. Let's find out. And I burned the shit out of that pizza and still ate it. And it was pretty, it was like you're pulling off like the bottom crust. And it's kind of, yeah, it's like those, we used to call them layer biscuits when I was a kid, like those Pillsbury biscuits that just have like all those layers. It's like, it's basically that.
You can't waste a pizza.
Pizza was consumed.
In Chicago, pizza's a holy item. So we take our pizza very seriously. And I know when you spoke to Nick Horween, you guys were getting pretty serious about hot dogs.
We did.
We also make a fine pizza.
Yeah, I blasphemed quite a bit, unfortunately. I like removed everything from the Chicago dog and added ketchup and somehow made it out of Portillo's without getting slashed. Wait, before I ask what shoes you're wearing, which is the most important question, what's your Chicago pizza place?
Well, behind the river of Horween, there's a pretty cool, lesser well-known place called Pequod's.
I've been.
Pretty big fan of Pequod's. Yeah, it's great.
Blackhawks gear everywhere.
Yeah.
Pequod's is good. The crust at Pequod's is arguably the best crust, I would say.
They've got the caramel crust. Yeah, yeah. Caramelized crust. You know, there's Giordano's and Lou Malnati. I mean, for me, it can't really go wrong with like a nice pizza masquerading as a lasagna.
Or the other way around.
Yeah.
What if I told you that Gino's East was my favorite? Is that like the same as the hot dog situation or?
No, it's good, man. I just feel like any pizza is a good pizza. That's why you don't want to waste the burnt, you know, croissant pizza. You just, any pizza is good.
So I'm a tourist is what you're saying.
No, man. Like, so I'll be honest with you. People that come visit me will always want to get the nasty lasagna pizza or whatever. It's disgusting, but it's really delicious. You can't eat more than a slice, really, unless you're nasty like me and eat two. But like day to day around here, we're eating thin crust. Like nobody's really eating deep dish Chicago pizza with like sausage wheels on it all the time. We're all pretty overweight here, but it's, you know, it's not a daily occurrence to eat a big nasty pile.
Which makes sense, but I don't know. I mean, you know, the passion behind it, the rage against New York pizza and the idea that Chicago pizza is somehow better, which is obviously patently false. Not that I'm from New York or anything like that. This is, I would say, a revelation and really, you know, kind of something that I would say reveals the truth about how people in Chicago feel about their own pizza. Said it.
Oh, ouch.
They just avoid it until someone forces them to go, it sounds like.
It's a special treat. You know, I mean, you don't eat candy every day, or maybe you do. I don't know. I saw you had that Snickers bar.
I actually have been. It's a Snickers bar with only one letter on the front, C.
The C. Well, I think the pizza analogy, I don't want to jump too ahead on you, but the pizza analogy is to me kind of like, you can make the analogy in leather. It's like, what's better, right? It, you know, it depends on what you like that day. You know, not every day I want deep dish. Not every day I want thin crust. Sometimes I just want a nice...
DiGiorno.
Yeah, or croissant pizza.
All the people at this Lions Club are going to think that it was delivery. But it was actually DiGiorno. And then Dick Vitale's going to run in and entertain nobody. Sorry, Dick. I know you're a listener. Yeah, I will. We'll wrap this part up and then maybe talk about shoes and leather and stuff.
Maybe.
By saying a coworker, an old coworker of mine, I don't remember what we were talking about or how we got there, but had one of the statements that's rung true in my head forever. Since then, I've like lost a bunch of weight, so maybe I was listening. He said, "Can't eat pizza every day, brah." I was like, "Shit, I think you're right." Unfortunately,
that's a deep, deep advice. You certainly can't if it's the Chicago one.
He set me on the right path. He set me on the right path.
Yeah, man.
All right, what are you wearing? What you got? Shoes, boots? What's going on here, Phil?
Yeah, I've got my my Patina Thunderdome pair on right now that I've been wearing for a little over a month. These are the Oak Street trench boots, and they have a cap toe and a leather sole, and I am digging them, and it's even better that you're forcing me to wear them every day. And I have been. I've worn them every day since the beginning of the Thunderdome.
You've actually worn them every day?
Every day.
That's crazy.
They're great. I love them.
As of today, we are 1 month and 8 days into this thing, and obviously this episode will not air today. I'm going to like check with you the day this episode airs and see if you've kept pushing them.
I mean, that's the point of the Thunderdome, right?
Like, I mean, it doesn't have to be every day.
No, I thought it was. But also, like, I'm enjoying them.
I'm glad you misunderstood.
Although, I did fall on my face wearing these. So, with the leather sole, I feel like now that I've gone towards the leather sole, I used to be sort of like rubber, day-night, Fieberman, all that type of stuff. I feel like now that I've gone towards the leather dark side, I don't know if I can go back because they're so comfortable, but I had to push a car the other day and I straight up fell on my face pushing the car. I thought, don't wear a leather sole and push it in a dirty road and like pushing the car. It was stupid.
Yeah, it's got enough traction for like one man and no cars. But you're right. Like a leather, I'm like wanting to get myself back into leather soles and something I'm going to pick up, but also like kind of sampling some collaborations for next year. And I haven't yet put it in because I'm bouncing between like a leather sole and, you know, like a half sole. And part of it's like, does everybody want this? And part of it's like, you know, if it's cool enough and can you wake people up who've never even tried a leather sole, which I think is a lot of the boot wearing public. But
I don't see the aversion to leathers. I don't understand why people wouldn't, but maybe I'm just confused.
Yeah, it's thought to be limiting in certain conditions, basically.
Mm, for slippery pushing a car conditions.
Yeah, slippery pushing a car conditions, yeah. Mostly. Yeah, it's like great in ice and snow until you've got like a F-150 that's somehow stuck in an incredibly deep ditch.
Yeah, I don't know if any boots are helping you at that moment, though.
All right, well, look, I'm glad that you're loving these things. They look fantastic. You submitted your photos dutifully. Yeah, man. Love it.
By the way, what are you wearing? I'll pick up the Ticho mantle and ask you what you got on.
We've kind of dropped this when we have guests because then, like, everybody just talks about their boots and, like, tells some story for a while.
Are you wearing one of your, I think you have two Thunderdome options. Is that correct?
I kind of do. I have one and 1A. So I've got my Alden 405 Indies from Alden Madison, which I've been trying to wear more, but it's kind of dead even with these sample prototype whites boots in Merriam Natural Horse Butt with an unstructured toe, which is not something that whites does a ton. You know, they'd never worked with this leather before. You know, you got to test it out. Yeah, there's a couple of things that we might tinker with, but hopefully it'll work. Phil, I'm going to tell you the truth. It's 8:46 at night right now. I put my kids to bed, had some delicious ravioli that my wife made, came downstairs and put on my Birkenstocks.
No shame in that.
Which I've actually been wearing a ton and have admitted as much on this podcast and in other places.
Fatherly evening wear.
Yeah. They're like the shoe ones.
I like it.
They're like my house slippers for now. But they're great. I actually tracked down. So they're the Bostons, the ones that are like, you know, kind of the shoes or clogs or whatever you want to call them. Mules, perhaps. I looked at all the options and there was this one leather. Oh, what is it called? Iron. And it's just this kind of gray. And I was like, I got to get those. But they seem to be like kind of out of production or something like that. And I eventually tracked down a pair on eBay for like $70, which is a steal for Birkenstocks. That was a possibly tried on and shop by hundreds of people, like floor model.
A little.
Or possibly just sat on a shelf looking good that whole time and nobody's bare feet ever touched it. Couldn't say no, and my feet largely look and smell the same as they did previously. So it's great. But I've like absolutely trashed these. I wore them all summer, wore them to the beach, like got sunscreen all over them, was worried that I'd ruin them, and they just like keep pushing through. I need to find out who makes this leather.
Iron.
Because I would toss it on a boot in a second.
Yeah, just reach out to Birkenstock. Hey, I'm the Stitchdown guy.
Yeah, they know me.
Tell me about your iron.
Like, why do your boots have backs to them? We can't speak to you.
Too much.
So that's what I'm wearing. I'm somewhere between minorly and completely unashamed.
I'm not mad. I've seen your pictures of the Thunderdome boots. Both of them are pretty nice looking.
They look good, man. Like, they're doing the job, and it's fun to know what you're going to wear most days, especially when you're, like, going somewhere or doing something. You're like, well, I got to pick one of these. You know, it makes decision-making easier, and there's definitely some lonely boots, but I also, like, change shoes or boots like two or three times a day just to entertain myself. Everybody's feeling all right. But look, today we are going to talk about leather, how it's made, get into it far more deeply than probably I've ever been in a single conversation, and really take it step by step in a way that I think is going to be very, very instructive to everybody. And I'm going to pepper you with questions because I actually don't know everything is like a nice way to kind of put my knowledge of how leather is created. I know how it kind of reacts to becoming a boot or a shoe, and you know how it ages and what's going to crease and what's not and what's more comfortable, like all these different properties of it. But the creation side, like I've never made leather and like I don't make leather goods, and there are a lot of things that I want to know that I think that everybody who cares about footwear can really benefit from. So the first question, Phil, is like, how the hell do you know so much about leather and what have you done in your life to obtain that knowledge?
Yeah.
Like build your credibility here so people like believe you a little bit.
Yeah. I started working at Horween Leather Company with my childhood buddy, Nick Horween. And essentially, I started there as a summer job about 15 years ago now, which is nuts. I'm feeling old.
You look great.
And that summer job, thank you so much. The summer job that was supposed to literally last the summer, a couple months, lasted 14 years, a little over 14 years. And that's sort of where I picked up my knowledge. And, you know, I have to give a lot of credit to Skip Horween, so Nick's dad, because if you ever meet the guy, his passion for leather is just completely infectious. It's a little bit of a shame that he came around before a lot of social media stuff, because the guy just has incredible stories. And when you're around him, he wants you to understand what's happening in his business and what makes him so excited about it. You know, the guy's the fourth generation leather tanner, so he's got quite a bit of experience and knowledge. So most days when I would show up to work, he would spend a couple hours with me and we would just walk around and talk about the leathers that we were seeing. And he would teach me simple things of how to experience a leather properly in his mind, certain things to look for.
Like what?
Well, so a very simple example is hard to describe over the air here, but if you take a piece of leather that's sitting on a table, he would suggest to grab it and sort of shape it as a clamshell, let's say, and hold it in your hand, and then sort of run your index finger or run the leather between your index finger and your thumb. And this sort of motion plus the grabbing of the leather gives you a few different senses. You know, just by running your fingers over the leather on the fold there, gives you a sense of how even the thickness is and even just how thick it is in general. It also tells you a lot about the feel. You know, is it smooth or is it sort of sticky? Does it have any grab to it? A little bit about the texture. And then also the temper. Is it firm or is it soft? So that sort of motion is the way he taught me, was sort of the ultimate first assessment of a lot of key features of leathers. It's awesome because before I started working there, I literally thought leather was one thing, and I just thought that it was brown. And I didn't realize that, you know, there were...
If you look at my boot collection, I think that might be true.
Well, yeah. I mean, and a lot of leather is brown, but it blew my mind the first time I saw blue leather. It's like, what? You can change the color? That's nuts, man. Even though there's infinite colors, really, color is such a small part of it, too. And then that sort of helped open up that wormhole of the different characteristics of the leathers. And, you know, that's something now these days, having run my own business making small leather goods, that has turned into sort of our passion of just trying to teach people and have people experience some of what I missed out on over 15 years ago. Like, what makes some of these leathers different? And there really is sort of like the pizza question between Chicago-style pizza and New York-style pizzas. Like, what's better?
Here we go.
Yeah, I mean, we're not going to fight, because to me, it's like, what's better, Chromexcel or, I don't know, Shell Cordovan? And it depends on the day for me. You know, I like them both. And there's no reason you can't enjoy both. That's also the challenge with the leather stuff. It's like, a lot of people ask me, like, I want the best thing. And there really is no best. So for me, the best thing we can do is to more of describe what's happening in the process at the tannery, the procedures that a tannery might take to achieve certain looks or certain feels, and certain things like, what are the inherent characteristics of different animal hides, for example. So for me, it's much more appropriate to describe things that we see and describe how we achieve those things, as opposed to just saying, like, this is better than that, because I don't think that's an appropriate question.
All right, should we do it?
Yeah. Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right, so Phil, we talked a while back and we're like, what should we talk about? I was like, pizza, and you're like, no, leather. And so we kind of compromised, but you drew up a really very, very helpful for me, and I imagine many others. And, you know, if you're listening to this on the Stitch Down website right now, you'll already have seen this chart. If you're listening to it wherever you get your podcast, go to stitchdown.com, pull up the article with the podcast with Phil here, and you'll see this chart in the article. So basically, it's a flow chart of, all right, you've got like a cow, I'm going to read it, steer, cow, horse, bison, deer, etc. Then it goes down into everything that happens in this process, veers off at certain points, just walks you through step by step. So basically, we're going to like go through that, think about how these things, whenever possible, kind of affect or apply to boot and shoe leather, which is important, obviously. Ultimately, I think that there's a huge learning experience here for myself and everybody listening at kind of any level of leather understanding to do it, especially because I'm going to pepper you with a whole bunch of dumb questions throughout, because that's how I tend to learn things. Elevated questions, sometimes difficult, but we'll see if we can get a couple of those in there too.
Yeah, so the chart here is a chart that I created that describes the most linear and simplified parts of the tanning process. This is all the processing from the hair on hide, the raw animal's hide, to a finished piece of leather that a company might start making a pair of boots with, and all the steps in between. The first step is the hide. The main types of hides that you'll probably come across are bovine hides. Now, at Horween, more specifically, you'll often find their steer hides. And the steer hides are very different than cow hides. And this is just a small example here, but most people say, well, you know, these leathers are made out of cowhide, but the cows are very different than steers because cows have babies. Their hides tend to be a little thinner. They tend to be a little less tight with the fibers, and they have a larger belly. And it's very different than a steer. And further to that, if you're making a heavyweight online boot, like Viberg tends to use pretty heavyweight stuff. The Viberg stuff can only be made out of a steer as opposed to a cow because the cows just don't get thick enough to make 6 to 7 ounce leather. So that's just a pretty simple example. We're on the top line here, but there's a really big difference between each animal hide. The other hides that you're probably most familiar with are equine hides. So you'll tend to see a lot of Shell Cordovan leather in the stitched down Patina Thunderdome, perhaps.
I love how much. More than I expected.
Yeah, the Shell Cordovan is probably the most famous equine leather. And it's specifically a leather found in the hindquarters of every equine animal. And you might be noticing I'm not saying horse. A horse is an equine animal. You'll also find that same dense fiber structure in mules and donkeys and zebras. But the reason you don't often see, you know, zebra Shell Cordovan is because there's not many zebras being bred for meat. So the big thing to remember here is every boot that you wear, the leather that's in there is a byproduct of the meat industry. And tanneries are another subsequent industry that just sort of specializes in byproducts and taking these animal hides that are going to rot and deteriorate and making them everlasting and durable and beautiful and then appropriate to be used on something like a boot or a shoe.
That's something that a lot of people kind of ask me, especially when it comes to you kind of decide to reveal that, you know, you have horse butt, which is a fairly easy to figure out bit of terminology that your boots are made of that. But it's definitely something that I reassure people about. And, you know, I think we very specifically asked Nick one of the listener questions, and he was like, yeah, I promise.
Mm-hmm.
So that's good. Next we get to, as it says here, dehair, cure, and strengthen fibers. This is tanning. This is, like, is that what you would call this next phase? Or is there, like, a different bit of terminology we should be using here?
No, the second stage is the tanning stage, and it sort of encompasses multiple functional areas in this one chart. I'm trying to simplify it down a little bit, but under the tanning umbrella, there's a couple different things. We're removing the hair from the animal. They're doing a process called baiting and pickling, which is removing some of the garbage from the skin, parts that we don't want, and then curing it as you would a cucumber to make a pickle. Just sort of penetrating it with salts and swelling it up. And then they swell it up to allow it to accept certain tanning agents. So the most popular two tanning methods that you'll probably see whenever you're searching for leathers are chrome tan leathers and vegetable tan leathers. Chrome tan leathers are more durable and strong and heat resistant, where veg tan leathers tend to have a better ability to develop patina and sort of darken and change in a little bit more of a pleasant way, in my opinion, as opposed to the chrome. Further to that, the chrome tan leathers tend to be a little bit more soft and flexible, as opposed to the veg tan stuff tends to be a little bit more dense and firm. And that's, there's exceptions to every rule, but generally speaking, that's the big difference. But the functional elements that make a leather chrome tan are by infusing the fibers of the skin with chrome salts. And these are little bits of molecules that bind all the fibers in that animal hide together to make it strong and fill in the voids between all the collagen of the skin and give it a lot of strength and heat resistance. The best way that's been described to me was by one of the tanners at Horween. He's like, it's kind of like making a leather like Wolverine, where he's part man and part metal. And the chrome salts are more metal. And when you go over towards the veg tanning side, it's more about infusing tree barks instead of chrome salts. So the word veg is a little strange. It could just be called tree bark tanning. To me, they're the same. I don't know how it's become to be called veg tan. But the veg tanning is done, instead of using the chrome salts, we're using tree barks to bind those fibers together and fill in all the voids. It's almost like making the skin part skin and part tree, in a sense.
Number one, fantastic Wolverine reference. I'm glad to hear that the kind of evil side of the Canadian government is the one who came up with all this stuff. When you say the voids, like what's the void? Is it the hair follicles? Is it other pores? Like what's getting filled in?
So visualize a cross section of a hide, and there's a grain layer on the surface, and then there's all these little mess of fibers underneath. And the way I like to visualize these fibers underneath that grain layer is sort of like a bowl of spaghetti. You know, all these little bits of fibers around, and they're sort of loose if you don't put anything in between all the spaghetti noodles. They're sort of separate and come apart. Well, you're able to bind in all those voids of space between the fibers with chrome salts or tree barks.
Got it. What would happen if you took a hide, did your de-hairing, and as you said, and I will definitely use pickling process, and then you didn't use chrome, use bark, whatever it is? Like, what would happen if you then tried to, you know, make that into shoes or wallet or whatever?
I've never done that, so I don't know for certain, but my suspicion is it would just fall apart. It'd be sort of like making a leather soup. You know, it would sort of just like deteriorate and fall apart. There's nothing to bind all that together.
Do you know when they figured out veg tanning, bark tanning? Who did that, Phil?
I don't know who the first person was to figure out to put tree barks in with animal hides. I don't even know how that could have accidentally happened, but it's certainly thousands of years old. Where the chrome tanning process is a relatively modern technology within the last couple hundred years, they figured that out. And on that note, it's very interesting. Even today, they're still developing new methods and new tanning agents to sort of bind those fibers together.
We got the olive, right?
Well, that was the example I'm thinking of, exactly right. So Horween has started very recently with this new technology called olive tanned. And you might find the olive tanned leather from brands like Allen Edmonds and Wolverine right now. I believe that they're the only two footwear brands using that leather at the moment.
Trickers.
And Trickers, too.
I think Trickers may have actually been the first from Weinheimer, German tannery.
Ah, excuse me. Yeah, so I must only be referencing the Horween stuff. But I should note that this olive tan is not exclusive to Horween. It's a technology that any tannery can use. So I'm sorry. Yeah, I didn't know that about Trickers. But the idea for olive tanning is the same sort of concept as veg tanning. But the big difference is instead of scraping bark off a tree, that's sort of a non-renewable resource. It's not very pleasant to think about, sort of ruining trees. The olive tan are just from fallen leaves, and they make the tanning reagents and the tannins from those leaves. And, you know, leaves will continue to grow on the olive trees, and they can continue to make leather from that renewable source.
Yeah, the idea of the fully renewableness, I guess, of the olive leaves, and also the idea that those olive leaves themselves become waste otherwise. And I don't know how much of that drove the idea to be like, well, let's try this one too, but I like it. We talk with Nick, anybody talking about leather, that like the tanning industry currently is light years away from where it was certainly, you know, at the turn of the century, or, you know, as I understand it, even 20 years ago. So the idea that a push towards continued sustainability is very much in place at Horween and other places, I love. But yeah, I think that I guess my next question is like, what else could be used? Like, could anything be used theoretically? Like, obviously not anything. Like, you can't tan a hide with like a bunch of Transformer toys or something. Like other natural substances that are there boundaries to this, or what do you think?
I have to tell you, I'm not a leather chemist, so I can only sort of speak to the things that I've seen and experienced. There's some aldehyde tannages. I don't know if there's a limit. I'm certain that there must be, but I'm not really knowledgeable about much else other than chrome and veg and the olive tan and aldehyde tannages.
All right, fine. We'll let you off the hook. You don't have to invent a new tanning method on this podcast, although it would be pretty cool.
The big takeaway from the second step of our process here is that we're taking a hide that will rot and turn into dirt, and we're curing it and making it everlasting.
It's pretty impressive. It really is.
You should be impressed.
I am.
I didn't invent this. I just have seen it.
So everything just kind of sits there, right? Do I have that correct?
Sits there.
Like it sits in a drum.
The drum has motion. So let me describe that better in a better way for you. In the chrome tanning process, most typically you'll find this process done in a very large drum. At Horween Leather Company, they use huge wooden drums. And you sort of visualize like a washing machine, but like the size of your house or maybe like half of your house. I don't know how rich you are, how fancy your house is.
I'm doing shoe podcasts. The house isn't that great.
let's call it a decent sized small house, right?
Okay.
Pretty large washing machine that just sort of rotates around, and it has the chrome tanning salt and water inside of it. And the action of that tanning drum as it spins around sort of penetrates all those chrome tanning agents into the fibers. You can also do it in pits, and you can find that more often in veg tanning. Something called pit tanning, it takes a lot more time for the tree barks to penetrate the fibers of the skin that way. But you sort of have to do it, in particular in the case of shell cordovan, you have to sort of slowly ease the tannins into that shell because it's so dense that if you do it too quickly, it sort of doesn't penetrate properly and it makes it a little too soft. By doing it slowly, you just get a better, more even concentration of the tannins into the shells.
All right, so the drum's a washing machine and the pit is just like a sink, basically.
It's like a sink with sticks run across the top of it, and then you hang the leather off the sticks into the sink, right?
Got it. How does this whole process like convince the chrome or the bark to go into the hive?
Yeah, so I'm not a leather chemist, but my understanding is what they do is they increase, and I could have this backwards, they increase the pH to make it very acidic, which allows the skin to accept these different tanning agents. And then they, after the tannins are inside the skin, then they reduce the pH and it sort of locks everything into place. So it's a chemical reaction that's happening to sort of tan the leather.
How the hell did anybody figure this out?
I don't know, man. I'm not smart enough.
It's kind of incredible.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the nutty part here is like, we're only on the first step basically. And there's so much to the process that's confusing. And there's terms, veg tanning, chrome tanning, top grain, full grain. You know, I'm looking at my chart here, genuine leather, there's stuffing. There's all these different terms that are mystifying. And I think the problem for me that really bothers me and it keeps me up at night is a lot of companies will use these different terms to try to sell their product, and it doesn't describe what the leather is in a full way. It doesn't have any meaning to it when you just say this is veg tan, for example. That doesn't have enough information. That's just literally the first step, because we have all these other steps afterwards that really, you could not make a leather with all these steps together.
Let's keep moving.
So we're about to get to the most important step in my mind here in terms of business function is grading. So we're talking about the leather here that is still very wet. And it's at a state that if it dries out, it turns into a potato chip. So there's a little bit of, you're sort of working against the clock at this moment. So the first step after the tanning, whether it's chrome tanning or veg tanning, is you have to have somebody take a look at the skin to see what it would be appropriate to make into. Does it have enough grain clarity? Does it have a lack of scratches and scars and brands, things of that nature to be appropriate to be used in a fine dress shoe or something like that? Or does it have a little bit more imperfections? Maybe we need to do some finishing to sort of cover up some of these natural imperfections. And then the most important part is the thickness. So the person will also sort a thickness at this stage and sort of, and this is the first point of delineation for the hide of where it's going to go and what it's going to be turned into. We have a process called blue sorting that can direct the leather to be turned into a football, for example, or maybe it's going to be turned into your pair of 4 or 5 Aldens.
How do you decide?
So have you ever cut yourself before or you have any scars?
No.
You're impervious? All right. Well, I've burnt myself making pizza. We're talking about pizza. I've burnt myself many times, like grabbing a pizza out of the oven.
I just burn the pizzas. It's like, who's going to get burned tonight? Pizza.
Not me. Well, so it's the scar that is on my skin are the same scars that you would see in this grading part of the process. The animals, the older they are, the more chances they have to become scarred and scratched and beat up in the field. That's why you tend to see a lot of rough hides on horse hides, because they live longer before they get to full weight. Where steer hides, they've really grown those steers quickly these days and really fattened them up quick. So they tend to be a little bit more clear as far as the grains. You got to also remember, these things are living in nature. So there could be a lot of bug bites. They could crap in the field and lay in it. It'll actually burn their hides in the same way that, you know, we both have kids, right? It's like diaper rash. It is a chemical burn.
Oh,
so
man.
You will see, we call it manure damage in the tannery. So you see all these imperfections.
It's a classy way to put it.
Yeah. Well, and there's some products, you know, if you're making a black embossed leather that's full of finish and pigment, you're never going to see a manure burn. But if I make you a baseball glove that has no finish, it's what we call a naked leather, or even an aniline leather, which is fairly, very lightly finished with dyes, you're going to see every little bug bite. You're going to see every bit of manure damage. And it's quite a large challenge. That's why this stage is so important.
So is it just cosmetic, or is there something else going on in this blue sorting?
It's cosmetic for grain clarity and then quite functional for thickness. So at this stage will determine if the leather's appropriate to be made into a belt, or maybe it's appropriate to be made into one of those unlined Viberg boots that needs to be extra thick. Things of that nature. The thickness at this stage is very critical.
All right. You know, kind of continuing in the same box on this chart, the splitting. I don't understand this. How does this work?
It's a little hard to describe, but we were talking about that cross section of the leather with the mess of spaghetti fibers, right? Visualize that for a moment. Is that mess of spaghetti?
Delicious.
It's so good. We need to make that thickness of leather to be consistent. If I sent Viberg or Alden or, you know, Grant Stone a leather that varied in thickness quite a bit, you would see that on the shoe. So we need to make it very even, or as even as possible at this stage. And it's called splitting. And the splitting department is a pretty challenging thing to do. There's two processes that a tannery will use to get the thickness to be of a prescribed amount. And one of the ways is running that thickness of leather into a very sharp knife. It's done on what's called a splitting machine. And this machine creates two products. It creates a grain layer and then something that we call a split. So the split is sort of the remnant, at Horween at least, that they're not trying to work with. They will sell that split to other suede tanneries where you can make very fine suedes. To me, this one little step has created so many marketing spin words that really upset me. This is where terms like top grain and genuine leather have come from, is this one little step along the way, which again, don't fully explain any information or convey any information about the quality of a leather. If I tell you it's top grain, I'm just telling you about how it was split. So it's a little troubling to me that people talk about top grain and genuine leather as if they're defining features of quality.
People can run with that kind of stuff. And one of the things that I love about, you know, the particular sector of the industry that we love is that you just don't really see that much of it, because there's a lot of other qualities of these products that are there to, you know, really just be told about. Like, I barely even think of a lot of these quality footwear makers as marketers. They're makers first. So I do love that, but I think it's a fantastic point and something to look out for, that when you hear some of those terms, caveat emptor, I guess. So it's actually being split. Like, is it being evened out?
It's being evened out by a mechanical process with a knife. And that sort of gives you a rough thickness. It's not precise at that moment. There's one additional mechanical step that gives us a little bit more precision. So think of this, the splitting machine, as a planer in woodworking. Just a plane. Mm-hmm. You sort of shave off a good amount. The second stage is more analogous to something like sandpaper, and that's done in a process called shaving. So they will split the leather. You create a top grain layer and a split, also known as genuine leather. Then we take the top grain over to the shaving machine, and they shave down the flesh side of that leather. So the flesh side is the opposite side of the grain side, and that shaving process gives it a more refined, even thickness. And it also sort of opens up the fibers a little bit to allow us for the next stage, which is the retan department.
Okay, so we'll get there in a second. So you've got the flesh side and the grain side. This is real 101 stuff here. I may or may not know the answer, but I want to hear it from you. Which side is like out on the cow?
The grain side. So the great question. So the grain, I was confused about the term grain again before I worked at the tannery. Even when I first started working there, I didn't really fully understand what the grain was. And the grain is very small. It's sort of like the hair holes in your arm, for example. It, the same thing is happening on a bovine. You're seeing these little bitty hair holes, and that's what I call the grain. There's also different texture that I've come up with a new word for that I called figuring. So if you ever look at like a shrunken shoulder, for example, to me that has a lot of figuring of the grain, where the grain character is a much finer detail. You'll also come across terms like corrected grain, which you may have heard of, where mm-hmm. they affect the grain layer with a bit of sandpaper or polishing cloth, and it sort of knocks down the peaks and valleys of that grain to make it a little bit more flat, even, and smooth. But to answer your question, the grain layer is the side facing outside of the animal, and the flesh side is inside of the animal. That would be touching its muscles or whatever.
Exactly what I thought. Yeah, I'm, you know, in some cases here, I'm asking real questions. In some cases, I'm pretending like I don't know the answers. Who knows which is which?
I don't think most people know any of this, right? So that's sort of, again, my goal as a person and a company right now is to share some of this knowledge.
Yeah, I think we're both trying to build a understanding and appreciation. Is there anything else from the splitting process that we need to know, or should we take a breather here?
There's some very important, one additional very important thing to mention about the splitting department here and the splitting process. That split, you can make an incredibly nice piece of leather from. And I know that people tend to think that genuine leather is not of quality, but if you're familiar with a company like CF Stead, they make incredible suede. There's many other leather tanners out there that take splits and turn them into beautiful suede. So it should not be a signifier of quality just to hear the word split or to hear the word genuine leather. Horween does not process any of their splits farther than just creating that byproduct. They will sell them off by the pallet, and they only deal in the grain side of the animal.
And it's just having focus and being good at something?
You're right. It's more focused. However, Horween is very unfocused. They make a lot of different stuff. So I don't know why their philosophy turned into not processing the splits, but they tend to be not the same customer base that Horween deals in. Horween generally satisfies the footwear industry and sporting goods industry, which tend to be grainy and thicker leathers, where the splits tend to be thin and sometimes a little bit less refined. And again, that's not the rule, because Stead makes incredibly fine suedes. It's just not what Horween's good at.
Got it. All right, look, let's take that pizza break. We'll be right back with Phil. So as you know, Ticho isn't here today. But luckily, I have thousands of hours of tape of him talking. So Ticho can kind of be here today. Just watch. Ticho, you may or may not have heard of this little thing, the Stitched Down Patina Thunderdome, presented by none other than Grant Stone.
Hey, Ben. I'm doing great. Thanks so much for asking. Just made some hot dogs. This is going to be great.
Well, we're now 3 official months into the dome, almost halfway through, and many a wise contestant decided to wear Grant Stone boots. 27 pairs remain in contention. We're going to run through a few pairs with a few different leathers and talk about how they're aging, and we've been posting them on the @StitchedDownPatinaThunderdome Instagram account for the last week, so you should definitely give them a look there as Ticho and I are talking to each other, the real Ticho. Ready to go through some of them?
Let's do it, man. What do you got?
All right, so one of my favorites is the Badalassi Saddle Veg Tan, which undergoes just an incredible color shift towards a much darker shade with hard wear, and is that rare kind of leather that looks just amazing with a whole bunch of natural creasing on it. Bunch of those in the dome, including one worn by Stitch Down Discord legend, Wax Daddy.
Dude, that's sick, man. That's legendary. Wow.
Then we've got some CXL. Grantstone has long been well known for how they cut their Horween Chrome XL, just making all the right choices to have it perform extremely well and look great over the long term. The navy CXL boots that I posted on the Thunderdome account look incredible. Vamp rolls, perfect little tiny creases, and they've clearly rewarded a ton of brushing.
Agreed, man. That all sounds right.
And then, of course, the shell boots.
That's true. I like that.
The Maduro Shell Edwards I posted are just fantastic. They don't look beaten silly. They just look perfect. And the Honey Shell Ottawas show what can happen when you do beat up a lighter color shell. So much color variation on different wear areas, little nicks all over the place, a huge patch of what seem like untreated scratches on the heels, and just beautiful rolls.
You can get that. That's a thing.
It sure is, actual Ticho. And you can get all of Grantstone's boots and shoes only at GrantstoneShoes.com.
I would go to that.
Of course you would. And everyone else should too. Thanks again for presenting the Thunderdome and just making fantastic stuff. Grantstone. Ticho, any final thoughts here?
Who's dealt with more hot dogs, me or Kobayashi? You know what I mean?
All right, we're back with Phil from Ashland Leather. We're talking about leather. Okay, Phil, so we've gotten the hide. We've tanned that sucker. We've graded it. We've split it. What's next?
The next part here is pretty significant because if we do not re-nourish the fibers of the skin, we will dry the leather out and it will turn into a potato chip. So the next stage here is called color and re-tanning. So a lot of people think about tanning as just sort of like a one functional area, but the retanning is where we reintroduce the fats and oils and the sort of conditioning agents to allow those fibers to become flexible again. Because we took out, in the tanning process, we took out all of the fats that were going to rot and deteriorate, and this is our opportunity to start to put them back in addition to a bunch of other products that might give us defining characteristics that we might want in the leather.
All right. So you also refer to this as wet stuffing. Is that kind of interchangeable with retanning?
That's a great question. It kind of is.
And look, Thanksgiving's coming up. Not 100% sure when this episode's going to air. I really do not like dry stuffing. And if that's what you're giving me, there better be a ton of really thick gravy. Just has to be said in case I show up at anybody's house.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a massive stuffing fan. I could go either way on it, though. I'm good with dry or wet. It's all good.
Flexible, Phil.
Rather have stuffing than the bird. Call me wrong, but...
Well, yeah, I feel like in some ways, very similar process, right? You got to shove it in the bird.
Yeah.
Get part of the bird to kind of... All right, let's go with that. We're like tanning the stuffing, right?
Yeah, let's go with this. So the tanning process that we did earlier, we took out all the gizzards and the crap from inside, the stuff we don't really necessarily want inside the bird when we cook it.
Look at this analogy I set you up for.
Now it's time to put some bread inside of there. We're going to put some sausage maybe. I don't know what you put, onions, whatever you put in your stuffing. We're going to put it back inside. That's not a great analogy for this.
Yes, it is.
But we'll go with it. So I wrote wet stuffing on the ledger of this particular column, but that was to sort of balance out what's happening on the right. There's a very specific way to impart those nourishing fats and oils and greases back into the leather. That is called hot stuffing. And that's a pretty uncommon thing. And Horween, it's a feature of what they're doing because all of the shell cordovan that they produce and all of the Chromexol as well as other leathers are what are hot stuffed leathers. And the reason it's called hot stuffing, we're actually using a large wooden drum that has been steam heated. And we need this drum to melt more raw waxes and oils and greases and pound them into the leather. In the same way we were sort of pounding chrome salts into the leather before, now we're trying to nourish those fibers with, like, think about beeswax, for example. It'd be hard to put just like a bunch of beeswax in the leather in water like you would do in a wet stuffing process. Mm-hmm. So we have to steam heat and melt those waxes and then sort of beat them in with the pins of the drum to create a hot stuffed leather like shell cordovan and Chromexol.
So I've always wondered about this. Like, again, how do you convince this stuff to get in?
You make an emulsion typically, and that's mm-hmm. what wet stuffing is. So you may have come across the word wet stuffing it's kind of a rare thing to talk about. More likely you've come across the words fat liquor. And a fat liquor is emulsified oils or waxes. And they can introduce those into the skins because it's water soluble. They can do that in water as opposed to having to heat up wax and sort of beat the living daylights out of it into the leather. It's just a little bit more gentle. You can kind of... It's a kind of a risky situation to heat up the leather and pound it, which is kind of interesting, actually, that shell cordovan being a veg tan leather that we're able to do that, because veg tan leathers are really susceptible to heat. They tend to crack and cook because they're less resilient, where the chrome is more like a metal. It's hard to inflict damage on a piece of metal as opposed to like a tree bark. It sort of cracks it. So they have to be a little bit more gentle with the cordovan as opposed to the chromoxel.
Is that why it takes so long?
This is a long stage, but we're talking about a week to 10 days for the entire hot stuffing and drying process. But the encapsulating length of time for shell cordovan is 6 months. So it's like a small, I mean, it's a long time for most tanneries. They could probably be done with most leathers in the time it took Horween to hot stuff some shell. But in the grand scheme of the cordovan process, it's very small.
What's the rest with the shell?
Why does it take so long?
Yeah, just so they can tell us it took so long.
Yeah.
You listening, Nick?
They want you to wait 6 months. No, it's the real answer is 2 months are in that veg tanning process that we spoke about earlier in the pits. So it takes that long for the shells to slowly accept those tree barks that we talked about.
Yeah.
Just for them to do it the right way. There's other stages later on where they're imparting other finishing waxes and oils to the shell itself. And they have to let it cure in the same way it took a long time for the shell to accept the tannins. It takes a long time for the shells to accept an oil in a complete way. And the big sort of secret, not secret here, is the longer the leather takes to cure and the longer Horween takes to do some of these steps that involve oil and drying, the better the leather becomes. So it's very interesting as a business decision. It's very interesting that as a business decision, the Horween family has decided to do things a little bit more slowly to make them better. Because I find it interesting because I think most people can't tell. They can tell the Horweens, and people working there can certainly tell that it took a week longer to let something cure. But I don't know if a lot of the world really understands. To them, I think it's a little bit besides the point. They just have a lot of pride in what they're doing, which is unbelievable because they could be turning around this leather. Like, there's no lack of demand for cordovan. They could be turning that 6 months of leather into cash a little bit more quickly. It's mind-blowing how patient they are with the return on capital there. I'm kind of surprised that they've done it for 120 years or whatever.
Don't change.
And I'm not, that's not bullshit. That's like all true. Like Skip can tell and he will wait an extra, like he could probably ship it out the door in like 5 months, but the 6 months you can tell the difference and it's a better product. So they just don't care. It's bizarre.
It seems to work.
Yeah.
What are our kind of options here for hot stuffing? Because it's different articles get different literally stuff, right?
Yeah, you might be familiar with the shell cordovan and chromoxel. They're very different outcomes. One of the more interesting things about stuffing is the oils and waxes that they're melting to put in there tend to be a little bit more earth tones and dark. So they tend to make all the chromoxel brown, and they tend to make all the shell cordovan kind of brown. There's a variation, in fact, there's a few variations on the chromoxel stuffing method that allow for brighter colors. So you may come across a version of chromoxel called Cavalier chromoxel, where they use a little bit less oils that allow the leather to become more vibrant, vivid colors, like a brighter blue, for example. And then there's other products. There's amazing products that Horween does called Illini Latigo that is hot stuffed, different waxes. And they all have characteristics that you sort of have to experience for yourself, but they can change the temper and they can change the feel. But sort of think about, you know, different maybe conditioners that you may have come across for your boots. You know, that you can buy a more oily conditioners and you can buy like a waxy polish. They'll give you luster, they'll give you feel, and they'll give you different looks. And the interesting thing is hot stuffing was actually invented by, I forget what company it was, but it was by a cosmetics, like the female, the owner's daughter created hot stuffing leather by using cosmetic waxes and oils, the same stuff that's used in lipstick. They figured out it would be great to be used in leather. So it's all the same stuff.
Interesting.
I know I'm a little rambling there with the stuffing because it's not the blend that is as significant as some other steps, but you can have a pretty wide-ranging world of waxes and oils. So it's hard for me to describe like all of them at once, but suffice to say that there's a unique proprietary blend for each of the different leathers that I can't really get into, but they will give you different effects in terms of temper and look and feel, and even the smell. I think a lot of the smell comes from the stuffing department.
That's why the leather smells so intoxicating.
And it's butts.
Oh, right, and the butts, yeah. That makes sense. Diaper rash, man. That was, you've been using a lot of wonderful metaphors, possibly similes, who knows. But man, the diaper rash really hit home.
I mean, I've got a 9-month-old daughter now, that so I'm pretty familiar with the cream in the butts at this moment.
It's like, oh boy, we're moving to Desitin for the next 5 days. And like, it never sticks to their butts. Is this too much? It never, you know, compared to other things that you might hot stuff a baby butt with. That Desitin just wants to slide right off. You're like, it's essential for this to stay.
Oh my God, Desitin! I don't think you can broadcast stuffing baby butts. You might have to cut that out.
We'll see how the edit goes.
We missed some pretty important stuff in the retanning department.
Oh, hit it.
So this is not just where we're imparting more waxes and oils. The color, the main color that you're often seeing is done in these drums. So you can impart a variety of infinite amounts of colors, but also you can create more characteristics that many companies might want, some might want to avoid. This is the process where you might see a leather become waterproof or fireproof, for example. You can also give it a retannage of veg. So Chrome Excel is a chrome tanned base tannage, and in this retanning department, we're imparting some tree barks into it. So you can give it a vegetable retannage, and that's what's known as a combination tan leather, and there's a bunch of combination tan leathers, not just Chrome Excel. I think that's pretty significant to talk about because you get sort of the best of both worlds, which is, I think, why they called it Chrome Excel, and they've been calling it that for 100 years.
Which, in Chrome Excel has always sounded like this futuristic word to me, but it's 100 years old.
Well, I think the funny thing is you talk about the color of Shell Cordovan Color 8, it's like all of these leather terms were before marketing was a thing. So I think they were like, oh, we've got some chrome tan leather here. Let's make it a little better. What do you want to call it? It's excellent chrome.
Yeah, we've decided to make it excellent.
Exactly.
Yeah, it sounds like Chrome Excel sounds like if C-3PO was like a different color. Like that's just what George Lucas went with, you know?
You'd be surprised at how many, like how unmarketable is Color 8 yet. That seems to be the most popular Shell Cordovan color. And even these days, like, it thinks you want to have a hashtag when you type it in. It's, like, so not right.
I love works. Color 8. Like, it feels old. Color 8 is like, well,
it's 8 of them.
We maybe have, like, 14 colors, and this is one of them. And, like, they literally don't even have names at this point. Okay. Like, we haven't decided to describe them in any fashion. Color 8, you know which one it is. Whereas Chrome Excel, like, it really does. It sounds like, don't take this the wrong way, Nick, et cetera, but, like, it sounds like, maybe it doesn't sound dystopian, but it's a little sci-fi. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And when you learn that the word is that old, you're like, wow, I guess they were ahead of their time, you know? I love Color 8.
The Chrome Excel story, though, is just, like, unbelievable. Think about the products that have been made. It's been in 2 world wars. On people's feet, but also in tanks and
gaskets.
Airplanes. This is crazy. So there are variations. Actually, the hot stuffing section that we were just speaking about will create variations on the Chrome Excel. One of the variations is called mechanical Chrome Excel, and in the tannery, they just call it M's. Before synthetic rubber seals, all motor seals were made out of leather, and for better or for worse, they function very well, but the big difference and the reason that they were so popular was because they brake slowly. So an operator of a service truck would hear his gaskets failing and they would know he had to replace
it. Get back.
Yeah, huh. And the other one's just brake and you're done. So leather, this you can still find some leather gaskets and seals, but they're much less common than 100 years ago when there's all over the two world wars. It's wild.
God, so much history here. All right, so we've retanned and colored and we have, you know, something that's approaching a leather, you know, more and more. Next up, what happens?
Well, at this stage, the leather's pretty waterlogged and heavy and just literally dripping wet. So we have to dry it. And this is a stage that a lot of people would never consider how significant the drying processes could be. But there are four different ways that horween dries. I believe this might be the only four ways that you can do it in leather. The most simple one to think about from drying is air drying it. Sort of just like you would dry your laundry, hang it up on a line. And all the chrome excel and shell cordovan is dried in that way. The thought process behind the air drying, again, like it takes about a week to 10 days. It's not terribly efficient. The thought process behind it is it makes a better product. And in addition to that, horween is nuts for doing it because it shrinks. In the same way that if I wash my raw denim, even let them air dry, they tend to shrink back in on themselves. The leather does the same thing. It wants to sort of pull in and you'll lose a couple square feet of leather, which is significant because the tannery sells the leather based on the square footage or the area of the hide. So shrinking it up, they're just losing money and it takes them a week. It's like a double loss. But the idea for doing it is that by shrinking that leather back in on itself will give you a tighter break. And I know what you're thinking, Ben. What are you thinking? Are you thinking, oh, I've seen some chrome excel with loose break?
Never said that in my life.
That's what I was thinking.
I've been lucky.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I have been too. I think, skipping ahead there, is, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with who's cutting and who's making the shoes and the understanding of what you're cutting and where it's going to be on the shoe. But, you know, chrome excel, I have seen loose chrome excel and it's not nice. You know, you can actually make it kind of nice by making it look like you meant to do that and just sort of like keep beating it up.
Right.
And off topic here, if you want to see, I have a tumbled chrome excel wallet that looks super awesome. Do you want me to grab it?
Yeah, go grab it.
Yeah. So we just did a private stock event today and sold like 50 unique wallets, and this is one of them. I don't know how well the texture will show up.
Terribly.
But, yeah, it's like super wimpy resolution here.
Yeah, it's not very good.
Dude, here, can we can do chats, right?
Yeah, we can do chats.
Here, let me just drop a link and you can see what tumbled chrome excel. So it's like if you sort of go with it and try to make it loose, it looks kind of awesome.
Ride the wave, baby.
Right. It's like so that's sort of my philosophy with leather is like, don't do anything that the leather doesn't want to do. You know, if you try to force it to happen, it's going to look contrived and stupid. So if you just, you know, sort of put it there and let it be, it tends to look a little bit more interesting and natural. I actually really like the way that this one looks, but if it was just where it was breaking on my toe, I'd be kind of bummed out, you know.
This looks good. This looks really good and not like a boot ends up breaking, unfortunately.
Mm. You can see, I've seen coarser breaks than this. Like, this is still, like, within the pleasant range.
This just looks like cool, grainy stuff.
It looks like a pebble grain leather. Like, yeah. Almost like a little bit more coarse version of the Arabica, perhaps, that Luxe leather.
Yep.
But I've seen it pipey and loose. You tend to see a little bit more fibrous, loose leather happening in the bellies and the armpits of the animals. And the super important thing that I like to talk about a lot is, why does that happen? And the reason is you're, what you are seeing when you see these pebbles and that sort of pipey look is you're seeing the grain layer separate out from all the fibers underneath that we've been talking about. And it's delaminating from all the substance below. So when it folds, and if you look at a loose piece of leather as a cross section of it, you can see it just sort of pop off the top.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all this pebble look is coming from. So every hide does have some looseness in it. Unless it's literally like a baby calf, which on that topic, big spoiler, is my understanding that no calf skin is actually true calf skin anymore. I think anytime you see the word calf skin, it's actually a kip skin or actually just a steer hide. And I don't think you find much true calf in the world these days. So cut that out if you want, but I think that's the truth. I don't think there's much calf at all.
Why?
Well, at the tannery, you could only buy kip skin. Like, the hide dealers only sell kip skin.
Adolescent.
Right. And I think there might be, like, they just don't make enough money on it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think people are buying veal. Or if they are, they're actually getting, like, kip meat. I don't know.
Oh, even the veal is fake.
I don't know. I'm being conspiracy theorist right now. But my suspicion is that there's not much actual calf or actual veal in the world. Why would they do that? Like, in the same way, like, Horween's just drying leather out in the air for a week.
Well, away they go, you know?
What are you doing? You're just losing money for no reason.
I mean, I'm not against a business decision, you know, keeping these cows around a little longer.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'm fine with that.
Oh, drying. We're on drying still.
Drying. We're still drying. So we got to air dry. I don't know why. I haven't seen Jerry Maguire in, like, 20 years, but the one line I remember, he's like, nah, man, I air dry that shit. So he's like kind of the same as Horween.
I don't remember that.
He's like, do you want a towel? And he's like walking around naked. He's like, nah, I'm Cuba Gooding Jr. I'm brash. And I just...
Oh, yeah.
I air dry that shit. You know why. He doesn't believe it's a better process.
Yeah, he's just into it.
But, all right, so we've got air drying. What else do we got?
Air drying is like the least tech involved, but you can also air dry in a process called toggling. And the toggling section is where you take these little clips and you clip the edge of the hide and you sort of stretch it out on a metal frame and let it air dry that way. So that way you're at least increasing the yield a little bit as it dries. But the effect of toggling has a definite effect on the grain. So it tends to create, in my experience, more interesting pebbled grain leathers. If you dry it with a toggling method and then tumble it, it tends to have more appealing pebble grain in my mind. But it also has like just a little bit more raised grain. And anybody that's familiar with a toggle leather might describe it in the same way. But to me, it's like the grain is a little bit more fluffy. Like it's not as pushed down into the rest of the skin. It sort of sits up a little bit and like creates little pillows up on top. Little beautiful leather pillows.
I'm tired. It's late.
Toggling is basically air drying while being stretched out.
Okay. And that's like the famous, you know, picture that, you know, all tanneries have put on their site or posted on Instagram at some point.
It's pretty cool looking. You know, the next one is even more crazy looking. It's called pasting. And I think most places do not paste leather. But what pasting is when they literally apply glue to the grain side of the skin and they smash it up against a huge glass window, basically. And that glass window gets the leather slicked out on it and sort of spread out. So again, we're increasing the yield and making more money, but it's also compacting the grain a significant amount and sort of flattening it against the glass. And it makes a pretty flat grain appearance as opposed to the air drying or the toggling.
Yeah.
I really like the way it looks. And if you're familiar with Latigo from Horween, that's a pasted leather. It's a pretty compacted flat grain. I like it a lot. And then it goes through an oven while it's on that frame and dries quickly. You can also air dry it on that pasting frame. It takes a few days. So that they like to do it in a couple hours through the oven.
And then to back up a little bit, you know, to get quote unquote grain leather, that is, I suppose, natural grain and not stamped. You get that through toggling and then tumbling, which is like not part of the tanning process, but part of the, like maybe even the finishing process, or what would you consider that?
When you say a grain leather, are you talking about like a pebble grain?
Yeah, like a pebble grain, like something that you look at it and like all leather has grain, but you're like, oh yeah, it's grainy. It's a scotch grain. It's a pebble grain. It's like, you know, intentionally grained as opposed to quote unquote naturally grained.
I see what you're saying. So you can fake a grain with an emboss or a deboss, but you're talking about natural looks. You know, scotch grain or like football texture, which people probably couldn't envision, that's all fake. That's not something that appears in nature. The grain through these different methods, you will see the grain in all of them. They just have sort of different levels of compactedness, let's say. So the toggling, they tend to be more, It's more opened, I would say. It's like a little bit more fluffy of a grain, where the pasting and the vacuum drying that we haven't spoke about yet, they tend to be more compacted and smashed in. You can still see the grain, but they tend to be, like, this is very nerdy. Like, you'd have to look at them side by side to be like, oh, that's very different. But the grain character is just different from the different drying methods. They're not more grainy or less. In fact, the animal itself might have more to determine that grain character, but the drying method will just make that grain more or less accentuated or like more compacted. It's hard to describe without showing you the two pieces next to each other.
So what's the vac dry then? Just like what it sounds?
Yeah. So the thing about it is, if you have a veg tan leather, remember, we can't introduce any heat to it, because around, don't quote me on the number here, people, but when you get pretty hot, I think when you're above 120 degrees Fahrenheit for an extended amount of time, you will cook a vegetable tan leather, and it's not pleasant. It tends to crack and it tends to look pretty unpleasant. So in order to dry something more quickly, typically you'll add some heat and suck out, I can get some airflow to sort of suck out the moisture. The vacuum dryer, you can actually use some heat at a lower level and evaporate the moisture, because you're reducing the pressure like a vacuum would do. And the reason that they do that in a vacuum dryer is they can do it at a lower heat and still dry it with some heat. And it sucks out the moisture like a vacuum would.
As it should.
Yeah, but you're pressing that leather again in the vacuum dryer. It's still being pressed against a surface. The grain layer is being pressed against a layer of glass, just like in the pasting. So you get a little bit more compacted grain on the vac dryer to a lesser extent than the pasting, however. All the drying methods do have a reason to exist, and Horween does them all. Now, a lot of places won't only do one of these. Speaking of that, is each of the sections that we've spoke about here, most of these sections alone are individual companies, but Horween is doing them all themselves. Now, you will find a company that their whole job is just to chrome tan, and you'll find a company and their whole job is to just do color and retan, and typically they'll dry it with the retanning too. But Horween's doing everything from start to finish. There are many, many, many leather tanneries that will only do one section of these. Which I think makes Horween a little bit different. They have some proprietary things going on, which is why they control it all in-house.
Makes sense. All right, so we've got our hide, we've done the tanning, we've graded and split, we've retanned and colored, and I think we've dried everything now. And now we're about to cross on your diagram the crust threshold. So basically everything that doesn't go through a finishing process would be considered crust. Is that what I'm understanding?
Yeah. So the reason I put the crust line there is because I see the word or the terminology of crust being thrown around. I think that's a confusing word.
Let's clear it up.
Yeah. So once a leather has been properly tanned and retanned and dried out, you could actually use it at this stage. And many people do. It tends to be a little firm. So you might find a tannery would slightly soften it before shipping it out the door. But you could certainly make really nice stuff with just crust. Crust is unfinished leather, meaning you're seeing pretty much everything as it came out of that retanning drum. You're going to see whatever color was put in at that point. You're going to see whatever characteristics were put into that leather, whether you've retanned it with a bunch of oils or waxes. You're going to see a lot of that, and you won't be changing it because you're just shipping it out the door. Crust leather is also known as naked leather, meaning that it has nothing applied to it. And then there's sort of a spectrum between naked leather, in this case crust, and a full finished heavily pigmented leather. To me, there's a spectrum between those two things. On the naked end, you get a very natural appearing thing, and on the full finished end of the spectrum, you get a kind of fake looking thing. Because on the full finish side, that stuff tends to look more like paint, because they're covering up the grain layer with finish that has solids in it, which is kind of analogous to painting a piece of wood. And then on the more towards the other end of the spectrum, without using paints, you can affect the color by applying stains or dyes that don't have as much solids in them. So if you're familiar with woodworking, it's kind of like staining your wood versus painting your wood. You can see through the finish layer on an anilin or just a dyed leather, and you can't really see through to the grain on a heavily finished or painted piece of wood. And the same is true in the leather world here.
Might be your best analogy yet.
Was it? Okay.
Quick sidebar. What's an anilin leather?
Great. I wrote a whole blog article about anilin leather because it's another word that just gets thrown around. And you'll see it in car commercials. Hey, these are great anilin leather car interior. But like, what the hell does that mean? Basically, anilin leather is crust leather that has had dye applied to it. And very specifically, the color that you're changing has no solids in the finish, meaning no paint, which means you can see through to the grain itself. In the same way as the wood we were talking about, that's what anilin leather would be, is if the wood was stained as opposed to painted. That would be an anilin piece of wood. I tend to like the more rugged sort of anilin stuff or even naked stuff. A lot of people like a really flat and even thing because, you know, when you're using dyes, you're going to see highs and lows in colors. And a lot of brands, especially a little bit more formal, more dress wear type stuff, needs a very consistent look. So that's part of the spectrum we were talking about, is you can make a semi anilin leather. You can add a couple drops of pigments into there that give it a little bit more coverage. So I would say I tend to see a lot of the boot world be pretty anilin or naked. And I think the more refined you get, the more finished the leather almost has to look, in my mind. I think it might even be inappropriate to make like a crust piece of Chromexol in like a dress shoe. Like, it just wouldn't work.
Certainly. Yes. Okay. All right. So we've kind of jumped over this crust wall here, you know, inadvertently through my clumsy questioning. But I think we're at finishing now, right?
Yeah, and finishing is like a massive, big job. And this is where my brain gets a little bit confused because it's non-linear. The finishing department I think of is just like a workshop with a bunch of tools, and like whatever you're working on, you might go over to this area and work with that tool, and maybe you don't, and maybe you go over to this one and work with that. But typically the finishing process looks something like this. You take the leather out of whatever drying method, it's very firm, so we need to soften it up. And there's a machine called a staking machine. It's also known in some parts of the world as a Melissa machine. There's other brand names of these machines that will use little pins that sort of vibrate together. You feed the leather through it and it sort of works the leather back and forth and softens it up. So that's the first stage. We need to sort of lay it out flat and make it a little bit more of the temper, or the final temper that we're looking for. The second stage, now that the leather's flat, we can start to apply finish onto it in an even way. If we had wavy leather, you would see modeling and sort of uneven finish. And you can apply the color in a few different methods. You can spray the color on. You can roll the color on, like you might roll paint onto your wall. You can brush the color onto the grain of the leather in the same way that you would take a roller brush and sort of roll it onto your wall. Or there's something called a roll coater that is a little bit different, and it gives a little bit more of a heavy coverage to the leather, but essentially it's like a big rubber roller that's just coated in dye and it just rolls right over it without any texture. So those are sort of the methods that you can use to apply stains, but you can also apply different materials to the leather, some of which will affect the luster, some of which might affect the feel. But generally speaking, after you put the dye on, you're going to be putting on an adhesion coat and then a top coat. And there's those three parts, the dye, the adhesion, and the top coat, are what is known as a finish system. And each of those parts of the system can be changed. You can make those adhesion coats weaker, you can make them stronger. And you might say, well, like, why would you want a weak adhesion coat? Well, you can get some pretty interesting effects on the leather by having that adhesion not be so strong. So if I put some stain underneath an adhesion coat and then a weak adhesion coat and then a top coat, and I tumble the leather, that finish layer, the top coat, is going to break off in chunks and in different ways. And you might get this like fun sort of look. And I think that might be a little bit of what you see in the Arabica Luxe leather, is like a little bit of a weak adhesion coat.
Mm.
And if we go to that top layer of the finish system, the top coat, you can get bright shiny tops, you can make a dull luster. You can make top coats that are UV resistant, so the sun will have no effect onto the leather. And it's pretty pretty deep, the amount of stuff that you could do in finishing. But the finish system is probably something that you see on most leathers, with a stain coat, an adhesion coat, and a top coat.
Got it. Okay. So again, the kind of the woodworking analogy at play here, I would say.
Yeah.
More on the painting side. But like, you got to get it to stick.
Yeah, it's like painting with primer would be an adhesion coat. Mm-hmm. Is same sort of vibe on the leather. That's a perfect analogy. If you don't put down a nice primer coat, I've actually had it on my current home that I bought from somebody else. I don't think they used a good primer before. So when I put masking tape to repaint the walls, it actually ripped off the old finish. Yeah.
In terms of footwear, boots, kind of maybe even staying away from like a really fine like dress shoe leather, which of these are generally used? All of these things, and you know, kind of at different levels, or like are all these steps always deployed?
Yeah, the things you tend to see on most leathers are stain coats, adhesion coats, and top coats, and then you got to sort of smooth it out on the end, and they'll run it through a machine called a plating machine, which you can put a mirror shine to it. It's called a smooth plate, or you can sort of sandblast it, or you can even affect and sort of fake the grain with something called a hair cell. And I think you were alluding to that a little bit earlier, sort of faking the texture of a real grain.
What's it called? Hair cell?
Hair cell.
Hair cell.
Like the cells of your hair.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like the grain, the little dots where the hair is come out of, is something called a hair cell. So one example, we were talking about earlier in the grading part with manure burns, you know, the diaper rash for the animal. If we want to cover that up, you don't want to look at that, right? So if you want to cover that up, we might put a heavy coat of paint down on it, a full pigment finish, and then maybe we put like a little bit of wax on it and then put a hair cell over the top. And I almost guarantee you couldn't tell the difference. So you can sort of upgrade leather at this stage by using finish and using different methods to emboss the leather. And it's a vibe too. Like, there's some really impressive hair cells in the world that you could never tell the difference. And there's some pretty bad fake looking ones. But there's also totally wacky textures that I like. There's one that Horween does called the Western. They're probably most famous for the football texture that they emboss or deboss onto every piece of leather that gets turned into an NFL football. Same thing with the basketball leather. They do all that texture. So that's all pressed in to the leather. In those examples, not to hide anything, but you can certainly cover up a lot of natural imperfections by putting a texture or finish over the grain.
When are those decisions made? Is it at the outset? Is this when you're grading after you've run the initial tannage, or and then things get put in a different pile and they say, all right, this one's a football?
This is why I was saying earlier that grading was the most important function. It's because all these decisions are made at that grading stage. So as a tannery, they're accepting orders from all different companies, different footwear brands, different sporting goods companies, different small leather goods companies like my company, Ashland Leather. And they're trying to determine what all these random hides are going to be turned into. And it's at that initial part, that first grading, where they determine what they're going to turn it into. So they can see, the very experienced sorter at that stage can look at it and say, well, you know, if I put this into baseball glove, it better not have any scars on it, because baseball glove is essentially crust. And if I put this into some other leather, I'll make up one called Legacy. I know that Legacy is going to get a lot of finish on it. We're going to emboss it, and it's going to be black. He'll be able to put some of that manure burn or scars and scratches into that color or that product instead, and nobody will ever be able to tell. So it's very critical for whoever's grading the leather to know what the demand is for what people are ordering, as well as the supply of what he has sorted out. And it's a very, it's more of an art form. To balance that properly. But if he starts to put very clear grain selections into lower tier products and vice versa, he could put that company out of business pretty quickly.
Interesting. Even more interesting, you may or may not know that Red Wing SB Foot has a leather called Legacy. So, you know, shots fired here.
Horween also has a leather called Legacy. I don't know why I chose the word legacy, because it's not full finished or pigmented, but just pick any word, because that's all they're doing when they're naming these leathers. Just imagine a leather that has like a, it's black and it's got a really intense Scotch grain print on it or something. You're not going to see a scar or manure damage or anything like that underneath. You can cover up a whole lot of stuff with a texture and just a ton of finish. It can look nice too. That's not to say it's bad. It's just, that's how a tannery works.
What should it be used for?
Right. It's appropriate for that.
How is it best used?
You know what, man? I'm wearing these natural Chrome Excel trench boots right now. And there's a really big scar on the inside quarter panel. And I kind of like it. Like, I embrace the natural character of it. Because number one, I know it's unavoidable. Like, if you look close enough, you're going to find an imperfection on any small piece of leather, even just a cut part of a boot, you'll find something wrong with it. But it also makes it unique. In my mind, if you wanted something to be absolutely perfect and the same every time, it would look fake. That's where I always notice is that there's this balance between natural and beautiful character, and like a little bit fake looking and very consistent. You kind of can't have both. And that's why I try to envision the spectrum of like something that is very naked in finish and is going to show me everything. They tend to age a little bit better too. And then something full finish that's very consistent and even, that's very clean looking too. And it tends to not age very much on that end of the spectrum. You kind of can't have both at the same time. You're never going to get a precisely clean, well aging thing that has very even color or no imperfections. It just doesn't exist.
Totally. And like, you know, dress shoes, whatever that means these days, kind of make up, I don't know, maybe 5% of my shoe collection, maybe 10. And I want them to look like they're supposed to look. And you just want them to look clean and great. And, you know, you're upset if you do anything to them and you're careful when you wear them.
Envision some tuxedo shoes that were made out of like an aniline leather. It's just like so not right. It just doesn't meet that vibe. That's what I was saying earlier. Like some of the first things you talk about is like, what's better? It's like, it depends. There's no like 100% black and white here. For a tuxedo shoe, I might not even want leather. Like, just give me something bright and shiny and black, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I personally, if I wore enough tuxedos, I'd kind of be like, yeah, let's like Thunderdome these tux shoes and like show everybody what's really up. But yeah, like one of my all-time favorite pairs of boots, you know, a little biased here, but my own decision, so it's fine. My friend Rizky, who runs Underhood, one of the Indonesian makers, you know, we did this limited collaboration. I think we did 12 or 14 pairs total. And he had this Wicked and Craig veg tan leather that was absolutely beautiful and has only gotten better. And he shows me this hide and he's like, well, look, we got this one huge, gnarly scar. He's like, you know, what should I do with this? I was like, give it to me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want somebody else to be unhappy with it, but also, like, I want that. And put it anywhere you want. And he put it right on the big bulbous toe of one of these lineman boots. And I love it. And you can see it less and less the more you wear these things.
Interesting. That's cool.
But it's still there. Well, I mean, it's just everything happens to them, right? Like, mm-hmm. There's more stuff going on. When you get them, it's like, that's the thing that you see.
Right.
But from day one, I was like, he made the perfect decision here. Not to, you know, hide it on the quarter or whatever. It's like, just throw it right there. Yeah, I love it. It's like for a pair of boots that you wish to have character, it gives that to them immediately, and then more character develops around it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like I don't want that on certain pairs of shoes that I think for whatever reason should look more pristine.
You know what? You're very right. And the Ashland, we sell many, many wallets. We sell a lot of wallets. And I don't think I've ever had somebody send one back to me because there was some imperfection in the leather.
That's great. That means you're educating your customers from go, because I'm sure there's a lot of people who buy your products that aren't leather junkies or, you know, boot crossover guys who are necessarily ready for that.
I think about half of our customers are unknowledgeable, which is awesome. Like, I actually want that number to be bigger. Because that's the goal. Like, we're trying to teach people and like let them experience like the difference. But the reason I brought that up is, you know, we probably aren't cutting very much crap, but also like we certainly have cut stuff that that has an imperfection. Like 100% every day, like I said, you're never going to find a piece of leather that doesn't have something with it. The interesting thing about it though is like I get people that are more upset about them carrying a wallet in their pocket with their keys and really denting and scratching it up. And people are really upset about that. It's hard for me to explain to them why that's not okay. You know, I think people are very used to, we're talking about finishing here. I think people are very used to heavily finished and scratch resistant types of leathers. For this reason is these larger companies will be receiving feedback about how their wallets or shoes or whatever scratch up and they get complaints about that. So they try to fix it. So that's why I think you see larger brands tend to be very consistent and they tend to be very scratch resistant and they're almost like not leather at a certain point. And that's why there's an opportunity for like everybody that's hanging out on the Stitch Down Discord, like everybody there is more discerning and has a really incredible patience to think about what they're buying and understand it. Like I can tell you as a person that has to sell these things and deal with the feedback, it's like it's hard to teach people that your keys are going to scratch the leather. And that might seem like a no-brainer to everybody that's going to listen to this, but like most people think that the things that they get should be impervious forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of missing the point, at least for what we do. And I think most people in this scene get into is they want something that's going to change. They want something that's going to reflect their lifestyle and sort of develop with them. And I think that's sort of a new concept for many people. We tend to see people more in like the raw denim world get it a little bit better, but that's such a small minority. So I guess my question to you, let's flip the interview background on you.
It's like, this never happened.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go for it. Do you think that this is something that's going to be forever understood to be just a small niche? You know, people that like patina and are accepting of wear and development on their boots? Or do you think that we're going to continue to move towards a more, I don't know if refined is the right word, but do you think we're going to continue to move more towards a very finished, sort of like perfect looking shoe world? Where is your head at?
Well, I mean, we've all seen visions of the dystopian actual future where everybody's wearing the exact same thing and shit's really clean.
I haven't thought of that, but that's a good point.
that part, like, you know, my house having to be clean perfectly all the time sounds incredibly dystopian to me. But no, I think that, look, when I got into this, like, you know, boots, shoes, etc., I'd been into shoes of various kinds for a very long time. Sneakers, especially, cleats for sports. Like, it's just, it's always been just, sometimes it's kind of like boiling under obsession, and then it started to boil over. You know, with the sneakers, I had shoes that I wanted to keep fresh, and if there was a possibility of it raining, I wouldn't wear them that day.
Hmm.
Guess what? They stayed fresh, and it's a different kind of leather, and that's what I wanted specifically. And when I got into boots, like I knew, you know, I had some Thoroughgoods, I had some Iron Rangers, but when I got my first pair of Aldens in brown chrome XL, that first scratch was like, no, what have I done? Like, toss them.
Right.
And then everything kind of develops around that, kind of like the scar on these Underhoods. Once you kind of get over that mental hump, like it's a little easier. And like you see in this Thunderdome, like people are like, give it to me. And sometimes quite aggressively. I think that is just, it's kind of an easier way to live life. Like you can enjoy something quote unquote bad that happens to something. You know, like I have, I don't know, shirts, sweaters, pants where you're like, oh man, I got this big splotch right on it. And like, I'm dropping food or child is throwing food at me all the time. And I'm like, I'm not there with everything, but it's not things that are necessarily designed for it. That's why I love wearing denim because like, I don't care. I simply don't care. And I barely wash it. And like, you just kind of, you know, I'm like, I'm wiping my pants.
Just throw it in the freezer or whatever, right?
Yeah. And I think it's, one, it's like kind of easier to do that because shit's going to happen, and so let's roll with it. And two, once you really begin to accept it, you know, again, people are going to push things and people are just going to let it happen, and I think both of those things are great, But the mindset is the same, that, you know, this can actually improve just by living with it. And I don't want to throw any of this shit out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think overall that mindset from like a worldwide sustainability perspective is very important, number one. And two, like, I'm still in the middle of this, and by the time this episode airs, I probably won't have published it. But you know, I'm writing this manifesto for, you know, what Stitchdown wants to do and be in 2022. But my goal is to, like, wake the whole world up to the very legitimate joy of quality footwear from a true comfort standpoint, from a health standpoint, obviously, like, a longevity standpoint, but just, like, how happy this stuff can make you, how it kind of makes your day better when you, like, only think about your shoes all day long, which I'm in the fortunate position to be doing. And this is all part of it, right? Like, you can have specifically made stuff for specific occasions, the tuck shoes that you mentioned, you know, like just dress shoes in general when everybody's shoes look good and you don't want to look all ragged, like that's fine. But day to day in the lives that we live, especially in, you know, the kind of the world that exists today, I think that like it is important. It's important to like go out and do things with your life and not be afraid of what's going to happen to like the stuff that you own, and in fact embrace that. Yeah, I mean, it's no surprise that we're in kind of the same boat for this. But I like to think and, you know, have some ideas on how to make this happen. And a lot of it is through this kind of, frankly, education. Like, I think that this, everything that we've talked about today helps people understand why things happen.
Mm-hmm.
How the whole thing got there, and that, you know, these natural materials are capable of, like, frankly, incredible things. So, yeah, man, I'm with you.
I love literally everything you just said. It's really, really cool. And it's really wild to think about, man, my shoes I'm wearing right now are $600. It's crazy. Or, hey, that wallet that you sell, Phil, that's a $100 wallet. That, who's going to pay that? You know what, though, is one of my buddies told it to me the best way. He's like, man, life is so tough. He goes, I would pay any amount of money for any amount of joy. And for me, like, one of the companies that we do business with is a really good representation of how I feel about like my boots and my wallet and stuff. It's like every time I go to pick up my metal comb that has like a shell cordovan leather sheath, it's so unnecessary. It's like this beautiful, like, it's actually the one I have is titanium. I have this titanium comb in a cordovan sheath, and I use it for 10 seconds a day. But it's literally one of those things you pick up and you're just immediately happy about something satisfying to touch and look at. And I want everything I use to be that way. I'm super privileged to consider spending $600 in a pair of boots. But like, if I could only buy one of those, I'd rather just have one of those and wear the crap out of it like I am for the Thunderdome.
Which is the original idea. Like, everybody listening to this started out there, probably. I know I did. It's like, ah, great. I only need one pair forever and they look better when they're beat up. This is like perfect storm. Let's go. And now I'm hosting a shoe podcast. So, you know, that gets inside you. And now we're really getting deep. But like, I studied a lot of Buddhism in college. And like, to really oversimplify this and probably be completely wrong, is like stuff and things that exist in the world don't actually exist. So if we like them, we're never going to reach enlightenment because they're actually not real. And it's far more complicated than that.
Hmm.
I try to follow that, but I really make an exception on that when it comes to, like, especially boots, but yeah, also things. Like, I have a Chloe natural horse butt, you know, kind of little card wallet from our buddy Jesse at Garter Goods. I'm sorry, Phil. And
that's great.
I love this thing. And all my wallets before that were absolutely terrible. And, you know, you couldn't wait to throw them out. And, like, the last one I bought from Amazon because it was, like, the best slim wallet in the world. And then it, like, literally just fell apart one day. This one's not going to.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, it's going places. You know, there's something to that, right? Like, look, I like cars, like, a lot. Like, there's other things that I like that don't have these qualities but kind of make me happy whether they should or not. Again, like, the exception is here to be made for things that, you know, kind of feel more of the earth, which I think is important, at least to me.
While I'm interviewing the interviewer here, let me ask you another.
God damn it.
I'm taking Ticho's role here.
He never asked me a question.
Well, okay.
He just talks too much. We miss you, Ticho.
Yeah, I wish I got to meet Ticho. It's a shame that he's not here. But he'll be in the ads, right?
He'll be in the ads.
my question to you is, can you think of another material that you can use every day that actually gets better as you use it? Because I've been thinking about that a lot for years and years. You know, I carry leather in my pocket and been carrying leather in my pocket for 15 years. There's really, I know you like my wheat quote.
Oh, I never mentioned the wheat quote. Wait, hold on. So Phil's got a great wheat quote, everybody. Everybody has a wheat quote, but Phil's the best.
My wife trolls me for this quote too. She thinks I'm an idiot, but it's true, man.
So Phil says, imagine being a wheat farmer who harvests grain all day. Not even wheat specifically. It could be any grain, but never bakes anything.
That was like me at the tannery. Like I would be making sheets and sheets of leather, but I never got to experience it in a full way. I would literally cut off little squares of leather and just put it in my pocket to see what it would do. And I think that was sort of like a natural progression into the wallet stuff. I think that's why I like leather so much, is you can use it and it gets better. And I just don't think there is anything else. Maybe wood stuff?
Yeah, I would say definitely. I do a little bit of woodworking and absolutely wood. And I mean, you mentioned it before, like denim, certain fabrics, I think, have a similar quality.
I tend to blow out a lot of crotches, Ben. I don't know about you.
Dude, it's the main thing. It's like, oh yeah, this denim will last forever. It costs $300 and you got to pay $30 every time.
You just got power crotches.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do? But yeah, there's definitely something special about the end product. A lot of things special. It's like a huge part of why we're here. If all these boots were made out of canvas, I don't think it would be nearly as interesting. And I'm sure some of them would be very cool, but it wouldn't be the same. And the understanding of how it happens, how it gets there, how certain decisions are made, I think that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like I've learned a lot today, and I think that like in my goal of kind of, you know, waking everybody up to what can be with everybody wears shoes, right? Like what they can put on their feet. I think it can go nowhere without understanding. And like certainly in terms of boot making and how complicated and expensive and time consuming it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with leather. So yeah, I think this is like foundational educational stuff for anybody who's in here. And I'm really glad we did it.
You know, we didn't really talk about the last step here because it's less of a step, but leather does get graded. The quick thing just to say about leather grading is it's graded by cuttable area. So again, every piece of leather is going to have a little perfection. You're never going to get 100% cuttable. And the shape of the leather is not like you're rolling out a piece of canvas. So it's graded on how many inside quarter panels can you cut on a hide. And, you know, you can get, most often, I think you get around 85%, I think is the average. But that's how leather's graded. Things that are 85 and up, let's say, I forget the percentage, but those are called TR, which I believe stands for tannery run. If there's a little bit less cuttable area, they're called specials. If they're under 50% cuttable, they're called rejects. That's how steer hide leather, bovine, and horse fronts are graded. The shell cordovan is one grade for quality, and the only grade is size of the area. So if you see a piece of cordovan that is graded as a 5, that just means it's 1 square foot. It doesn't mean it's worse than a number 1. It's pretty interesting how they grade stuff. And it's just because those ovals are all natural shapes. Not all of them are huge enough to cut a pair of boots, for example. So they'll charge more for a larger shell and they'll give it a 1 grading, and they'll charge less for a number 5 that might be appropriate for a couple watch straps or something like that.
So yeah, Nick sent me a couple definite reject shells that didn't get graded. Before we did the episode, he sent them to me. He's like, look, here are some things that we say this isn't good enough. And you look at it, you're like, guess what? I'm going to send this to somebody. Have them make me a pair of shoes. Because it looks pretty good to me, man. You know, maybe I've been brainwashed like by myself, but
honestly, you'll never find a bad piece of cordovan, and the reason why, actually you could find it, I'll take that back, but the way that Horween sorts it, they literally throw out things if they're imperfections. So if there's a large shell and there's like a big hole or some sort of imperfection in it, they'll cut that whole thing out and then sell the piece of leather as like what they call a chip, which is something smaller than 1 square foot. But you'll never see them sell it with that uncuttable area in it, as opposed to the bovine stuff. They'll sell you the whole hide because they're not buying a partial hide.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to convey that cost on to whoever's buying it, imperfections and all. But the Cordovan is like a sacred treasure. They won't put any negative imperfections in there, or at least intentionally so.
Well, yeah, I think I got a little hole, and I think I got some follicles, and hopefully both of those end up being shoes. I've asked some people. They're not big enough to make boots, but I'll be all right.
Yeah. I mean, they're not as nice. I mean, that's why they rejected it, right?
I'm not going to. Well, look, Phil, we've gotten through this whole process. Again, anybody who somehow hasn't done it, go to stitchdown.com. Check out Phil's little flowchart here, because I think it tells a lot and it's a great companion to this episode. But yeah, we've gotten through, you know, from hide to shipping, and we got to ship this episode, Phil. This is like way too long.
Yep. I got to go to California.
Yeah, you got to go to California and stuff. Phil, we're smart now. I can't thank you enough for all of this. It is just fantastic. Huge thanks to Grant Stone for sponsoring this episode and always using wonderful and often deeply interesting leather in their boots and shoes. Love you, Grant Stone. Don't forget about Stitchdown Premium in the Discord. If you join and you hate it, I don't know. I'm not sure what'll happen, but DM me, I guess. But most of all, thanks again to you, Phil, for coming on and just learning us good on leather. This was great. I think we should do it again sometime.
It was a real pleasure to be here. And if anybody wants to reach out with any questions, I am It's Phil on the Stitchdown Discord, and I'm happy to chat up anybody there. A lot of people IM me, and I'm super happy to chat.
Keep them busy. Oh, all right. That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.